This program was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television license fee. This program may contain material that some listeners may find distressing and also features some strong language.
Addiction is something that affects our way of thinking and our way of experiencing ourselves. And the behavior in some way gives us some short-term benefits, but it may kill us in the long term.
Addicts, they lie, they'll cheat, they'll do anything to get their drugs. They will tell you they're clean when they're not clean. They will do everything, and they suck the good out of everybody.
An addiction is, I suppose, a habit that takes from life rather than adds to it.
Addiction is you want more. An addiction always wants more.
Don't know just where I'm going.
Welcome to the third installment of our series on addiction. In this episode, we will take a look into the world of gambling and gambling addiction. According to the latest reports, there are estimated to be between 28,000 and 40,000 people who suffer from a gambling disorder in Ireland. We have the third highest gambling losses per adult in the world. Irish people are estimated to gamble over 5 billion euro per year. That's 14 million euro per minute. Less than 1% of those who need treatment for gambling addiction actually receive it. Adolescent gambling in Ireland is 2 to 3 times greater than that of adults. 1 in 5 problem gamblers attempt suicide, more than double the figure of other addictions. And Ireland currently has no dedicated gambling addiction treatment service. Barry Grant from problemgambling.ie explains how a gambling addiction differs from other types of addiction.
Well, the main differences, say, with the gambling addiction and the substance addiction would be that very, very often with a gambling addiction, people seek help very late in the day. One of the main reasons for that is that it's so easy to hide a gambling problem or a gambling addiction versus an alcohol problem or a drug problem. If you have an alcohol problem, you're going to be smelling of drink. You're going to be obviously intoxicated to the people around you. You might be coming to work smelling a drink. Somebody at some point is going to become aware of it and maybe intervene or say something to you. And similarly with drugs. With gambling problems, quite often people will keep it very hidden. It's very secret. They can be taking out loans in secret. They could stop making the mortgage payments without their nearest and dearest knowing about it. And quite often then people hit rock bottom very, very late in the day and seek help very late in the day, and they tend to be in a very desperate place. And psychologically as well, it's different in that if you are giving up alcohol and drugs, you just remove those things from your life. Like, none of us needs alcohol to live. None of us needs cocaine or heroin or other drugs to live. But we all need to have access to money, right? You can't remove money from your life. So a gambling problem is much closer to, say, an eating disorder where, okay, you have to stop gambling, but you have to be exposed to this trigger, which in the case of the person with the gambling problem is money, and you have to learn how to deal with that and manage that. And you might never have learned how to do that in your life, and that makes it more complex in terms of treating somebody with a gambling problem versus, say, an alcohol problem or a drug problem.
To find out more about the world of gambling and its pitfalls, we speak to a man who gambles professionally for a living.
My name is John Dineen, and I was, I suppose you could call it a professional gambler at this stage in life anyway, but I've, say, about 30 years involved in gambling and bookmaking, working for bookies, working myself for bookies. Now, I just go out alone. Basically, what I do is gamble most days of the week for a living, basically. That's basically in a nutshell. Because I'm almost solely dependent on making that pay to live, basically. That's basically it. From when we were younger, we'd be betting everything. Dogs, horses, poker, every kind of stuff. But as you got older, you learned to specialise in probably horses, yeah. Because you can only specialise in probably one maximum two things. Like a lot of fellas bet on everything, like GA and like the bet. And that's where you'll fall down, because you can't know enough about everything. You know what I mean? Very few are good at more than one thing. What I would describe my thing as now is, the best I could describe it to anyone would be a controlled addiction. Where like when I wake up every morning, like I want to bet. But it's somewhat controlled at the same time. Like if you like, I sometimes there, maybe in the winter when the whole place is frozen over, there might be no racing for 4 or 5 days. Geez, after 2 or 3 days, I'm saying, like, how am I going to pass tomorrow? Nothing to do, you know what I mean? Because there's nothing else I do really as such, like, but I watch the telly, what about normal people, but I've nothing to do really as such during the day. So I do like betting, like, at the same time. I don't do anything else, but I do actually. It's not a chore for me. It's not really like a job or going to work. It is a job in a sense, it takes a lot of time, but I still enjoy it at the same time.
So, how does a professional gambler differ from a novice or from those who become compulsive gamblers?
Basically, if a fella's in a betting shop and they're in there every day, they back a loser and the next thing, where's the next race? You know what I mean? Whereas fellas that do it professionally say, I can put my tools away, I leave it till tomorrow, you know what I mean? There's always tomorrow and there's always the day after and whatever. Like, there's no such thing as the last race, like, you know what I mean? There's, like, as fellas say, like, I heard they'll be racing again tomorrow, like, you know what I mean? And they're real, and they'll be racing, and the following day. So there's no such thing as the last race as such. But some people go to the races, and maybe they're having their day out, and like if they're losing with 2 races to go, they're going to have a bet in the last race, because they won't be racing again for months and months, whereas we do it every day of the week. And as I said, there's no such thing as the last race. It'll be starting off again tomorrow, and you'll be doing the same thing, and the following day the same thing, and so forth. But what can happen at times is if you get a run of bad luck, You can sometimes say, geez, I'm off my rocker here, and do something that you wouldn't normally do, and you'll usually pay the fine for doing something like that. That's so instead of losing 100 euro, say, of a day, you lose 300, you know what I mean? So the pros the should be able to manage themselves. They'll come out on a day, and when a day they should lose X amount of 1,000, they don't lose 3x, you know what I'm saying? They'll walk out the gate losing, and they'll be on an even keel again tomorrow, and the first bet will probably win and they'll have X back. Whereas the other fellow is after losing 3x, and he know where he is going home, you know what I mean? He won't have any money to maybe bet the following day. That's the way it works, and it's all about keeping your head, and keeping your head is the most difficult part of what I do anyway, of keeping the stakes within reason, betting within your means. And like, it's a long game, there's so many opportunities nowadays to bet that there's no rush, basically. Like, and if you can keep that in your head, there is no rush. Like, but some guys go in at 3 and they come out at say 6 and 7 and they go in with say 20 quid, and they come out with nothing. They say, well, sure, this it cost me 20 quid for it, but I got a bit of entertainment out of it. That's okay if you can handle that kind of stuff, like, you know what I mean? But invariably it leads to more than that, like, you know what I mean? It leads to the fella going up with, after spending the money for the housekeeping gone, and then you rule the boule when you get home with the wife and all that kind of carry on. And that's gambling can lead to a lot of problems, like, for people that can't control. And it isn't in, it's like the biggest thing I always think is the controlling it. It isn't easy to control it, because the urge, if you have that kind of bug, and a lot of people do, including myself, I have a bug like as well, but I can manage to keep it under wraps. But it isn't easy to do that at the same time. It's so easy to lose the run of yourself. Like in anything, like as I say, in drink and drugs or anything like that, it's so easy to, and that's how people get themselves into bother eventually, you know.
So does he come across many people who have gotten themselves into difficulty through gambling?
You see it every day of the week. Like you don't know what happens behind closed doors, but you know that there are people betting that can't afford to bet. And I really feel sorry for people that work 5 days a week and then they give it to like petty power at the weekend, like in the space of 2 hours. Like, I can't get my head around that, but people do it, and I see it happening. You see it happening week in, week out. It's terrible, really. And the betting shops nowadays target those people. They want you betting in fivers and tenners and scores, and it's a slow drain, and eventually they get every shilling off you that you're willing to give to them.
What is it about gambling that is so addictive?
There is an addiction to getting money for, it's like free money, isn't it, like, really? Because you don't do any physical work for it. And that's, I think that's the I think that is a real draw to people, that you can actually win. You can get a day's wages, for a normal day's wage for a fella. Like, he can have his 20 quid in a horse, it wins it 5 or 6 to 1. It's like it's a day's wages to normal people. And they're delighted with it. Like, it's like working, getting an extra day's wages for the week. You know what I mean? So that's, I can see how the addiction is that way. But it is a very addictive thing. And but the obvious difference is, and the huge difference is, like, I walk out the door of my house, I could be after losing price of a car, maybe. You know what I mean? But my next door neighbour don't know that. But if I walk out the door after 6 or 7 pints and falling down the ground, then they know, like, he's a bad alcoholic. You know what I mean? It's recognisable. Or if I'm out of my mind on whatever, cocaine or whatever you do, you know, that kind of stuff. Like, the people will know. But, like, I go and say hello to people. I could be after winning or losing, like, whatever. It could work either way. But they're not going to know how I'm after just getting on in the day or whatever. Like, I'm coming down the stairs from at home. And as I said, I've won or lost maybe pretty big money, but no one is going to know, only me.
There's a still in the street outside your window.
Now 25 years in recovery, Sean's life was gripped with a gambling addiction from a very early age.
My first bet was as a 12-year-old. I came home from my lunch and my older brothers and sister were sitting around the table and they were picking out horses for Cheltenham. And I asked, could I pick out a horse? The horse won. I said, I didn't get any of the money. But the buzz I got out of that, and when I was home first from school, obviously, and when they came in from work, I felt 10 foot tall, and they walking down the hall. And my eldest brother asked me, how did you pick that one? And I felt magic. And that was the start of the buzz. And I suppose from that day on, I was hooked on it. I gambled mainly in the bookies. And I'd go into school, I was doing a paper round and a pools round, and the pals would be going to the dances on a Saturday night, and by Saturday night I wouldn't have the money to go to the dance. So from a teenager, gambling was controlling me and owning me. I met my wife in my 20s. We got married when I was 25. We had 3 children. And the gambling kind of came in and out. I would get a loan. When money get tight, we'd be behind with the mortgage, the ESB, be a double bill and different things, and I'd get a loan. But I always got double the loan that was needed. Enough to clear what we had gone behind, and then enough for further gambling. And that just went on for quite a number of years till around the 90s. I went into business on my own and basically ran wild. I had a cash flow that I never had before. And the gambling hugely increased. For the last year before I came into Gamblers Anonymous, I couldn't answer the phone in my home because 9 times out of 10 it was someone ringing looking to be paid. The doorbell was a nightmare. I used to jump when the doorbell would go because it was somebody calling looking for stuff. I had about 8 bank loans gone, credit union, and so many suppliers that were owed money. I had created a huge, huge mess. I often gambled in big money and got cleaned out, and I'd go back out to the car and I'd gather up the change that was in the car for the tolls or whatever. And I wouldn't go back into the bookies I'd been gambling in the big money. I'd drive towards home and go into a different bookie with change to put on a bet, trying to win back. That's the craziness of gambling. Things weren't good. My wife was talking about leaving, and things weren't good in my home for the last year and a half of my gambling.
I promise tonight not to do no harm. I promise you, babe, I won't
do you no harm. And we're caught up in the crossfire of heaven and hell, and we're searching for shelter.
He now mans the Gamblers Anonymous phone line for part of the week in the Cork area, but James was another whose life was thrown into turmoil by gambling from an early age.
I started gambling, I suppose, when I was very young, the age maybe probably 9 or 10, playing cards, throwing coins to the wall, nearest to the wall, playing pant, poker, brag, niner, and all these card games, you know, in street corners with other friends. And I suppose that was my introduction really to gambling. Like, I suppose just being a child really at the time, I didn't know any different, you know, with the friends around the place. It was like a pastime, I suppose, really for me. And I suppose even at that young age, looking back at it now, I suppose I'd nearly consider myself probably a compulsive gambler at that age, like, because I was always the person who wanted to stay on for an extra game, or you know, if I was losing, probably get a couple of pence off the friend, like, so I could stay in the school, like, you know. But going from there, I suppose it really took off when I found, for me, when I found casinos at the time, you know, inside in town. My friends were playing, I suppose, pool and stuff like that inside there. And I found the slot machines, you know. And I took to it like a duck to water, really, you know. I suppose there were these dark, dreary places that you probably wouldn't see, you know, a person two machines up from you, like. And that suited me with the secrecy, you know. That went around my gambling, like, I suppose very quickly it went, as I said, from the Saturday, all day Sunday, Friday evening, you know, half day at school, you know. And I suppose I remember at that time coming up to leaving cert, you know, a lot of my time was spent, I suppose there was a small bit of sport involved, but a lot of my time would have been spent inside on the machines, like, you know. By the time I was 19, as I said, my parents found out, like, that I had a problem with gambling because money went missing. And after the period, you know, after being forced into a situation, I suppose, they got it out of me that this money was gone to gambling, like, you know. And my mother made a phone call for me at that early stage, like, but I suppose I wasn't ready, you know. And I went in to get out of a situation, and that's what I done. And I went into I went into Gamblers Anonymous at the time, you know. And but again, I suppose maybe the fact that I wasn't in any financial trouble and I was listening to other people, you know, inside there who were, I went back out after a couple of months, like, and I came back in after another couple of months, you know, again being found out, you know. But again, it was all about the stealing and the lying, you know, and all this at that present moment, like. And again, no financial problems, like, you know. Again, I went back to Gamblers Anonymous, and I suppose at this particular time, like, I realised that I was a compulsive gambler, you know. But, you know, I loved the gambling, like, it was probably part of me, and, you know. But I knew there was something not right with doing it.
James's gambling followed him into adulthood and was soon causing problems in his marriage as the addiction worsened.
You know, there was money going home every week, and then I was keeping my part of it. But as time went by, you know, there was less going home, and the more I was keeping, you know, to gamble, like, you know. And then it came to the point, like, where I had to go to banks and institutions, and, you know, I was borrowing from people. And, you know, I suppose even at that, like, I was able to wangle around it, you know. For me, like, I was able to work around it because, as I said, I was earning good money, like. But unfortunately, this just gets worse and worse, like. And then again, after a period of time, I suppose I had my first child, and I thought it might change, and, you know, I'd give it up now, and, you know, I had my first child and everything was going well. But no, you know, I couldn't stop, like, and eventually, like, you know, the bank started sending letters, the, you know, people were looking for their money back, like, I was making excuses not to pay this money, like, you know, because I always maintained that there was two pockets. There was the pocket that I had for, I suppose, you know, the bills and the food and the mortgage and stuff like that. And there was the pocket I had for my gambling, you know, the money inside each pocket. Like, the money for the gambling could never, ever go into the household money, you know, the spending money. But the household money would transfer into the, you know, very simply into the gambling money, like, you know, the pocket I was holding the money for to go gambling. Like, I remember in occasions, you know, after coming out of a casino, like, after how many ever hours, like, I would be very angry with myself. I'd be very disappointed. I'd be shouting at myself, you know, whether it be in my head or a load, like, you know, I might get back to the car and I'd be hitting the wheel and, you know, calling myself names and, you know, how stupid are you, like, for blowing all this money, like, you know. And what would happen then is I would sit into the car and I would be heading for home, like, and the further I'd be travelling, the less angry I'd be getting, you know. And then suddenly, like, it'd be, where am I going to get the next money from? Where am I going to get the money, you know, that I need to bring home? Or where am I going to get the money, you know, to go gambling, like, you know? And that's what it was all about. And at this stage, like, gambling was in my head 24/7, like. The last bout of my gambling, you know, it truly went out of control. Because every time I went out there, it got progressively worse, you know. But the last time I went out there, again, my wife found out, to shorten the story, my wife found out that it was after me gambling, no money coming into the house again, like. And, you know, she was angry, as right she should, you know. And unfortunately, this time I didn't want to stop, you know. So therefore, you know, I continued, but I left the house, you know, so that I could keep gambling. And that's where my gambling really took, you know, a thing, because I suppose there was a casino around the area that was open 24 hours a day, you know, and that's what I was doing. I was gambling 24 hours a day, wherever I could get the money from. I just could not stop, you know. And for me, like, I suppose I ended up living out of a car, you know, for the period of time, like, that I wanted to continue this gambling, like, you know, for a couple of months. No, and that was the worst period of my life. My parents had an idea, I suppose my wife had an idea that I was gambling, but I wasn't admitting it, you know. They thought I was living in a friend's house. They didn't know what to believe, like, as you know, I did look, I could put on the fake smile, you know, I could talk normally and stuff like that, like. But on the inside, like, you know, I was slowly destroying myself, like. The last day of my gambling, I was heading to my parents' house to beg, steal, rob, it didn't matter, get money from somewhere to continue my gambling, like. And something radically changed. Between the leisure centre that I was just after having a shower and shave and changing my clothes, to not remembering a part of the journey, right? And for me, I ended up outside, I suppose, grotto, right? And I broke down on my own for how long, I didn't know, right? And I suppose when I started coming about, you know, and started realizing that, you know, there was something drastically wrong here, like, you know, I remember saying to myself, I have to do something different here. I can't continue. I said, this is killing me. And they were the words I used in my own head. This disease is killing me.
One of the questions we asked both health professionals and contributors during the making of this documentary was, why do people become addicts? And there is no easy answer. Is addiction an illness or a disease? Does it boil down to genetics or individual biology, family history of addiction, peer pressure? Or does the reason really matter as long as a person can recover successfully from their addiction?
That divides professionals as well, because some people will really believe that it's an illness and some people really believe that it isn't. And honestly, the truth is we don't know. We don't know yet if there's a neurological or a physical basis for addiction. We know that there is some evidence that you can be genetically predisposed to develop a dependence on certain drugs. But that doesn't mean that there's a gene for addiction, if that makes sense. And genetic predisposition is not destiny. That's the other thing, because choice comes into it.
I'm sort of convinced that there's an addict in every single one of us, certainly in the Irish population. You know, if life goes against you, you know, or if your job is going against you, we all take to, you know, let's have it on the way home from work, let's have a pint. And then on the way home from work, well, I'll have 2 pints tonight. And then that just builds up and builds up. And I'm actually fairly convinced that certainly in the Irish gene, there's an addictive gene in there somewhere for the vast majority of us.
There are neuroscientists out there who would say that about 10% of the human population are biologically predisposed to become addicted to things that will help them to produce more dopamine, which is this pleasure neurotransmitter in our brains. So if you take a line of cocaine, you get 10 times more dopamine than you would normally produce. So you get that high. Similarly, you can get that dopamine hit from gambling and from other activities. So there's a theory out there called the reward deficiency syndrome, which is a biological theory that a certain amount of people are born with this syndrome, don't naturally produce enough dopamine, and find other ways of forcing their brain to produce it. So for one person, it might be cocaine, which is huge at the moment. Somebody else could be gambling. Somebody else could be another substance. So that theory is out there. But then, you know, down in Cork recently, you had a really interesting guy called Gabor Maté doing a talk down there. And his whole theory is about trauma. And a lot of people would subscribe to that, that at some stage in our lives, whether in childhood or later on in life, we've experienced some sort of a trauma. And, you know, that will feed into the anxiety. And then we'll find ways of coping with that trauma and coping with that anxiety. And that could be through substance misuse, or for many people, it can be through gambling as well.
If I step into a hole out there in the yard and I break my leg, okay, finding out how the hole got there doesn't do anything for my broken leg. Okay? So my first task is get myself sorted out, get myself well, get myself stable enough, whatever else. Now, it would be quite foolish of me to keep looking at that hole when I'm well and able, crutches gone, cast gone, everything else, and I'm well and able. To be very foolish of me to be looking at that hole and wondering how it got there without not doing something about filling it up. So the next thing to do would be fill the hole and get it out of the way. You know, or if there's a particular reason why that's occurring, then yes, of course, I would need to address it. So for some people, it's a case of deal with the addiction, deal with the present. And I suppose addiction is rarely about living in the present. Very often people are either living in the past or living in the future. Some people would say, let's say, a certain experience in childhood was the cause of their addiction. But if that was the case, everybody with that experience in childhood would then have an addiction. But that's not the case either.
Other people say it could be just something in me, you know. I never pinned it down. Never bothered me. I have it. And, you know, I'm not going looking for the reason why, you know. As I said, you know, I'm in good recovery. Sometimes there is reasons, and sometimes it's just company, you know, just in the wrong company. So, like, for me, really, you know, as I said, I was 8 or 9 when I started the gambling, like, or 10, whatever age, you're very young age, like, and I just took to it at that age, you know, like a duck to water, you know. So, is there a reason? I don't know. Some people say there is, and sometimes you have to find it. Sometimes it could be just the fact of running away from life, you know, running away from problems. And for me, I've certainly done that.
Unfortunately, people with gambling addictions seek help very late in the day. And by the time they present themselves to health professionals, they're not in a good place.
Common traits of somebody presenting for help when they've got a gambling problem: high levels of stress, high levels of anxiety, often would be depression there as well, and unfortunately very, very often with gambling problems there's a very high incidence of suicidal thoughts. Quite often the person is in a serious financial situation. They may only be telling their loved ones, or their loved ones might only be finding out about it at that time. So it's like a bombshell going off in the family. They may be, you know, about 1 in 5 people will steal to feed their gambling addiction. So quite a lot of people coming in have been caught, say, stealing from their employer or elsewhere. So they tend to be extremely stressed, very low mood in terms of depression, and quite often suicidal thoughts going along with that intense kind of desperation and hopelessness.
No matter how desperate the situation is, however, if people want to stop, then there is help available. And there are a number of different treatment options available for people, depending on their individual situation and circumstances. We paid a visit to one of the leading treatment centres in the country, Talbot Grove in County Kerry, to speak to Con Cremin about the treatment process.
The great thing about addictions is that, yes, they're treatable and people can recover from them. Now, recovery, I suppose, is about actually being able to live comfortably with yourself in your own skin in the world we're in. Okay, so it's about having a healthy relationship with yourself in your own skin and a healthy relationship with the world you're in. You can cope and function in that. And anyway, that's a life journey. So in many ways, recovery is a life journey. It becomes a way of living life. So from that point of view, it's ongoing. Okay, there's also, of course, the risk of relapse, and all addictive behavioral processes are high relapsing conditions. So there's high risks of relapse, but then they can be dealt with. There, you know, a relapse isn't the end of the world. It may be part of the journey to getting you somewhere, you know. So they're ongoing conditions, but I suppose our objective is to help people, first of all, I suppose, understand and get insight into their addiction, their condition, call it whatever we will, and to be able to cope with it and to be able to live with it, knowing that I have it, but I don't have to act on it. Okay, and that's the difference. I have it, but I don't have to act on it. And that's what recovery is about, is that I don't have to act on it. I have other ways of coping. And when I'm struggling or I'm stressed or whatever else, I have supports. I have other ways of dealing with life. And that's really what the objective is, you know, deal with the addiction and continue to live your life to the best of your ability. Gambling, most of it, like, it all happens in the head. The amount of time put into the actual transaction of placing a bet or whatever else, which is very, very easy now because it is in your pocket. You can do it. You don't have to see the money. You can just do it. But the amount of time to do it is very little compared to the amount of mental energy that goes into it, the thinking about it, the preoccupation. It's all the time there. So I suppose that's part of what people are looking at in treatment now. What they very much look at, what's the net effect of what I'm doing? And usually it's the consequences of my addiction, be it gambling or anything else, that will actually really motivate me to change what I'm doing. So we very much get people to look at that and then to develop the ability to live life, cope, manage without needing to get away from it, without needing to escape from it, or without needing to believe in that someday my horse is going to come in and all my problems will be solved, because they won't.
So, does the treatment and recovery process from a gambling addiction differ greatly from a drug or alcohol addiction?
The recovery process is very similar. You continue to, be very vigilant about how you think, and you avoid things that are associated with your gambling in recovery. So very similar to any other addiction, you know. Gambling has become more prevalent, but it's harder to see it in society. And I think we probably see less people in treatment for gambling than ought to be. But I think someday that bubble will burst as well.
James also spent time in a treatment centre, but found Gamblers Anonymous a huge help in helping him stay gambling free.
So, like for me, then I went to the treatment centre, and it gave me tools that I needed to start off, you know. And I went back to Gamblers Anonymous again, like, and that's where my recovery really took off, you know, through Gamblers Anonymous, like. But through doing it for the first time through GA and the GA way, you know. And I suppose for me, I started getting in regular meetings, you know, every week. I started listening to people who were around a long, long time, you know, and trying to figure out how they had done it. Even though I was a lot of years around Gamblers Anonymous, I choose not to do it the Gamblers Anonymous way, you know. And I suppose I wanted it. I wanted recovery, and I was going to, I was willing to go to any lengths to get it at this stage, you know, because this disease had brought me down to my knees.
Despite having its critics, Gamblers Anonymous is now celebrating 50 years in Ireland and has been a huge help to many people over the years.
Gamblers Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women. We come together to do something about our own gambling problem, and to help other compulsive gamblers do the same. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop gambling. There are no costs or charges. We're not a charity. We're self-supporting. And we pay for the rent for rooms, we pay the insurance, and we buy our literature. So it's all done by donation. And no one's ever asked, you didn't donate anything. It's basically free. It's run by the people who can afford it. The people who've got into recovery, they're the ones who can afford it. A Gamblers Anonymous meeting is closed just to compulsive gamblers. There's another type of meeting, an open meeting, held. A group could hold two or three in a year, and family members, friends, relatives can come to that as well. A normal closed meeting, there's a secretary of the group, and he would pick someone to do the chair on a night, and the chairperson will be the first person to share. How it works, I wish I knew the magic formula. I just found that the first thing I got from my meeting was, I was shocked by the honesty of these people in the room, because by being a compulsive gambler, I'd become a liar, a cheat, a fraud. It all goes with the addiction, the falseness, the hiding, the secrecy. It's a very secretive addiction. An alcoholic or a drug addict, there are outward signs. There's no outward signs for a compulsive gambler. I could pull back into my driveway, having had a disastrous day, and I could perk myself up and look, having looked all right, and I'm coming in. So it's a very secretive addiction. I found also that I got identification. I thought I was the unluckiest gambler going, and what was wrong with me, and why was I doing this, and why did I keep doing it, and why could I not stop? And I tried many times to stop on my own, but just couldn't. And I arrived into a room, there were 22 people in that room that day, a Saturday afternoon, and total strangers, but I just got such identification from them that, yeah, I wasn't stupid and I wasn't a fool. There was something wrong with me and I needed to do something about it. And they helped me to do something about it. They advised me, they guided me, they looked after me. And there's simple things that an addict can do, a compulsive gambler can do to stop gambling. Obviously, stay out of the bookies. We advise people on smartphones to get rid of the smartphone. Just get an ordinary phone. And then they won't be tempted on the internet to gamble. Don't carry money, tie up the money. All simple things. Obviously, don't watch racing on the television. Don't read the papers. Don't be looking up the form. And don't get involved in conversations about gambling. Just stay away from it. And for us, not gambling means, it says it in our book, we don't even toss for a cup of coffee. No lottery, no Boy Scout tickets, no tickets for the GAA club. I have to say no to everything. And it sounds a bit over the top, but for me as a compulsive gambler, if I go into a draw, I have a chance of winning something. So I get the buzz and excitement out of the possibility of winning something. And then if I don't win it, I have the disappointment of the loss. And there I am back to all the old feelings again over a ticket for a club. So if someone calls our hall door, I have to call my son or my wife and they come out and do the necessary. I can't do it. So for a compulsive gambler, we have to get rid of all gambling. All of it.
Gamblers Anonymous is a 12-step program for people who have a gambling problem. So what are the 12 steps and how do they help a gambler to stay in recovery?
They're a program for living. And the first step is we admitted we were powerless over gambling. And there's a second half to it and our lives have become unmanageable. The first word in it is we. So I'm not on my own anymore. The program is... Nowhere in the steps does it says I. It's all we, us and our. So we admitted we were powerless over gambling. And my life had become unmanageable. You know, I couldn't sleep at night. I couldn't work properly. The second step, and I kind of make it fairly simple. Second step is came to believe in a power greater than ourselves. Could restore us to a normal way of thinking and living. I believed in the fellowship. I came to believe that the guys who were in the room that started helping me, the advice they were giving me was working. So I just stuck with it. That's step three. Made the decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of this power of our own understanding. I made the decision to stay. I was going to stay with this and give it a really good go. That's what I did. Step four is made a searching and fearless moral and financial imagery of ourselves. We're the only group of people. There are many groups, AA, NA, ourselves, overeaters. There's many others. There's about 12 that I know of. I can't think of them all now. And they all have a step four, made the searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. We're the only ones with the word financial in, because finances ruled our gambling. When I had money, I gambled. I could stop when I had no money. It was easy to do it then. We're the only ones with the word financial in the step. Admitted to ourselves and to another human being the exact nature of ours. That's our step five. Having done a step forward, it's about sitting down with one other person and giving them the whole story, the whole truth. Six and seven are about character defects. We reckon we have that many problems, we need two steps on character defects. Step eight is about making a list of persons we had harmed, and step nine is about making amends to them. Step 10 is about continuing to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. That's about not repeating the mistakes on a daily basis. 11 is sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. And some people have said to me over the years that they can't do that one. And yet at the end of every meeting, we all join together and we say the Serenity Prayer together. So it can be done. As a unit, back to the we, as a group, we can achieve anything. And step 12 is about carrying the message to the compulsive gambler who still suffers. If I can't hold on to it unless I give it away, that's a simple rule in GA. And if I pass it on, the new guys coming in, they helped me to stay. I'm very lucky on a personal basis. A lot of the people that were in the room the first day are still around, and they're pulling me along and they're minding me from the front. And the new guys coming in, as recently as this week, they're pushing me from behind. They're showing me how serious the gambling is still now and how dangerous it can be. So everyone, from the longest guy in to the shortest guy in, we're all helping one another.
There is no one-size-fits-all approach to treatment for gambling addiction, and often it is a combination of the treatments available, including a treatment centre, Gamblers Anonymous, and counselling or therapy sessions that work best for people. And there are those who need just one of those options. The secret is to find the one that best suits you. Yale-based psychologist and psychotherapist Sally O'Reilly tells of her approach to treating addicts through counselling.
How I personally work, and this is how I personally work, I'm not saying it's the right way to work, because I know people do it very differently, but how I would personally work is that I would not accept that this person has a disease. So if they tell me they have a disease of addiction, I wouldn't buy into that, but I would be looking at what choices are they making on a daily basis. And how do those choices impact on their lives and on the lives of the people they claim to love? And I know claim is a very hard, harsh word, but it is one that makes people stop and think. And if the person truly wants to stop using gambling as a medication for whatever it is that truly ails them, they will. And that's what I've found. And I've, seen a lot of people very successfully change their behaviours, who would no longer call themselves addicts, who have not gone to 12-step programs. I would do a lot of work around the notion of shame and guilt and compassion for the person to themselves, because people do extraordinary things to keep themselves gambling, to keep that thing, to get that buzz. They will give up and sacrifice everything they have. And they will lie and cheat and steal, and they will feel horrendous doing it. One of the things I really like about the Narcotics Anonymous, I've often heard people in Narcotics Anonymous saying that they don't want to talk about the drug they use because that is not the issue. And what they mean by that is it's their behaviour is the issue. And that's true, I think, of gamblers as well, that I could tell you stories that would just make your hair fall out about what people have done and what they've sacrificed. But the thing is, really, is why? Why have they done it? And how can we support them to come out of that horrible, horrible place of shame, forgive themselves, address what's really going on, and allow themselves to be happy?
And what does a successful recovery look like?
I think of the, if we're to call them success stories, the things that they have in common is where the person genuinely wanted to stop doing what they were doing because they had an awareness that what they were doing was causing damage to themselves and the people around them. I think once someone has that, actually, over half the work is done. It almost doesn't matter what they do next, because once we have that awareness, there is the will to change. So, but what they would have in common, if I think about them, would be an unbelievable courage to meet themselves in the therapy room. And really, that's what it is. You go to therapy to meet yourself and to make a decision to forgive yourself, but also to understand that it's not everything is our fault. You know, some people do things to us. And it's getting clear on the difference between what has been done to me and what I have a righteous rage about, but also what now I need to take responsibility for in my reactions to that, if that makes sense. That's where the success is, where people can clear the difference between what's been done to them, how they want to respond to it, and then how they choose to respond to it in the future. And in that process, learning to truly value themselves, because as I said, with addiction comes this horrible, horrible mess of shame. And that can be the biggest obstacle to recovery.
So are the government and those involved in the bookmaking industry doing enough to regulate an activity that has been described as easily accessible, impossible to control, and highly addictive?
Under Irish law, a child of any age can place a bet at the tote. So the racetrack, horse racetrack or greyhound track, there's no age restriction on tote betting, right? And many of the clients that I've had, if I ask them, you know, if what they remember as their first gambling experience, quite often they'll say, oh, placed a bet at a racetrack. I was 8 or 9 or 10 or whatever, and I won a few quid, and that really stuck in my mind. And that can feed into the sort of distorted beliefs that the person develops about gambling through their lives, because obviously a child's mind is very impressionable. We actually, if you look at amusement arcades, like under the legislation, which is from 1956, slot machines are prohibited in Ireland. So every slot machine that you've ever seen in your life is actually illegal in Ireland, and yet the state still issues licenses for them. I mean, if you look at, say, you know, I was in Dublin recently, and I walked into a bookies just to have a nosy, and a lot of them have machines now inside the door, so you don't even have to go to the counter. Just go to the machine, put your money or your card in, put in your bet, and you get your bet and slip, and off you go. Looking at some of the kind of lax restrictions that are there, I mean, one of the things that really stands out, if you look at, say, the Tony O'Reilly case, where he stole 1.75 million from his employers on Pust about 7 or 8 years ago, I think he was caught, and placed it all with one online gambling operator. So every single penny of that 1.75 million went with one operator. Never over the course of that time did that gambling operator raise a red flag.
A guy is working in the post office next to a betting shop. He's coming in throwing 10 grand and 20 grand over the counter. Like, Jesus almighty, you didn't have to be Einstein to work out what was going on there, did you? Like, and that went on for years. He lost nearly £2 million, 1.7 million, and they won the world about it. Like, imagine me walking in the post office and yawn and going into Paddy Powers and saying, here, there's 20 grand. And I put it in there, and I'll be back in there. I'll have a bet there in a minute. And they'll say, oh, we do, and they'll make it, this, all this money laundering, all this rubbish. Like, but basically, those firms don't care where the money comes from. They don't. And the more of it, the merrier. The more of it that they can get off your man, the better. And if it's coming from any illegality, they don't care.
The nature of the business is to maximise your winnings by maximising the customer's losses, right? And within the gambling industry, they have a term called playing to extinction, which just is a frightening term in and of itself. But what that means in gambling industry speak is that if, whether it's a slot machine or any other form of gambling, it's designed in such a way to try and get you to play until you're out of funds, right? Whether that's the money in your pocket or the money in your online account or the money on your credit card. The idea is to get you to play to extinction, right? That's the way it's designed, and it's addictive by design. And that process works very well on a certain amount of people. Now, the gambling industry love telling you that only about 1% of the population has a gambling problem. If that were true, which it isn't, that would mean 1% of the population are giving them 40 to 60% of their profits. Now, they have no huge desire to get rid of that cohort of people because they'd be shutting up shop in the morning. But there has to be some way of regulating it so that people, obviously, who want to can go and lose their money at the bookies, but that the harm can be mitigated or minimized by having some sort of a policing through regulation there.
I got the soul, but I'm not a soldier. I got the soul, but I'm not.
So what message do we need to be passing on to the next generation, and how do we deliver that message?
We live in the real world where people do drugs, people drink too much alcohol, and people gamble more than is safe for them, right? So we have to operate within a real world context. So in the real world context, you go in and you say, some people gamble too much. That's what this looks like. These are some of the harms that people who gamble too much will experience. These are the risks associated with it. This is how you would know if you were gambling too much, because you would experience relationship issues. You might feel angry, you might feel anxious, you might feel depressed. Giving them information on what harmful substance use looks like versus what a safer version of that substance use would look like is considered best practice around the world.
The strongest message I could give to anyone anyway, I'd strongly recommend anyone that has kids coming to 18 years of age to discourage them completely from gambling, if they could at all. Because we've reached a stage now where it's not gambling anymore, it's just losing. You cannot win. You ain't going to be allowed to win. That's it in a nutshell. By anybody. Nobody is going to leave you win. And if you're allowed to have a bet over the counter, trouble-free, or on online, where there's no restriction, where they don't restrict you, well, you're doing it wrong. And it's a game that's for very, very few people. I wouldn't encourage anyone to do it anyway. I wouldn't encourage anyone to do it, because you have to have a special mindset. It's like, put it this way, it's the only thing I know, but I couldn't change a tire in the car. They can do anything, like, bar what I do. You know what I mean? Like, I would be, like, I'm doing it all my life, but I couldn't do, a fella comes in to do a job, you couldn't change a light bulb even, you know what I mean? Do you know what I'm saying? But I would discourage anybody, especially with kids, like, growing up, because it is addictive, and it's no good to you, and it's never going to be any good to you. Like having bets is, it's a waste of time, basically, and it's a waste of money, and like if you're it can lead to anything in the end, and especially if young fellas are getting jobs and getting good jobs and they've access to money and they're going out on their own, and you give away the money for no reason. Like, there's much better things to be doing with your money. I'd go mad if our own kids were got involved in this anyway. I mean, I would really know, and it can't lead to anything good. It can lead to all sorts of problems, but if you don't start it, you're much better off.
Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste.
My name is Holly McCarthy Thompson, and I'm 15 years old, and I'm going to be trying to make a Paddy Power account. So I've just gone onto the registration page here. It's asking me for an email address, so I'm just going to put in my own email address. So now it's asking me for a password, so I'm just going to put in a random password. It's now asking me to confirm it, so I'm going to put that in once again. So now, as a security question, it's asking me what my mother's name is, so I'm going to put in Eileen. It's asking me what country I'm from, so I'm going to say Ireland, and what currency, I'm going to put in Euro. So now I have to continue to step two. So it's asking me for my name, so I'm going to say Holly, and my last name, so I'm going to put in McCarthy Thompson. And it's asking me for my date of birth, so obviously I have to say that I'm over 18, so I'm going to put in my date of birth as 1990. So it's asking me for my phone number, so I'm just going to put in my phone number. And it's asking me for my address, so I'm going to put in my address. And it's asking me, do I agree to the terms and conditions, so I'm going to click that I agree to them. So now it's asking me for my postcode, so I'm going to put in my postcode. And now I'm going to see if I'll be able to join, so I have to click join now. So I'm actually in, so I'm after making a Paddy Power account, and I'm now into the website.
This programme was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee. Produced by Dara Parker. Presented by Ruth Hayes. Edited by Thomas Marr. With special thanks to all those who made this programme on gambling addiction possible: Con Kremen, Sally O'Reilly, Dr. Declan Matthews, John Deneen, Barry Grant, Holly McCarthy Thompson, and those who shared their own personal stories of addiction with us. A Community Radio Yule production.